This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll hear from a Western Michigan University student who says the issue of immigration reform is so important, it's worth her getting arrested in Washington, D.C. But first, environmental activist Bill McKibben. In his latest book, Oil and Honey, McKibben writes that sometime in the course of the past decade, I figured out that I needed to do more than write. If this fight was about power, then we who wanted change needed to assemble some. The subtitle of the book is The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Bill McKibben is also the founder of 350.org. He will speak tomorrow night at 7 o'clock in Miller Auditorium at an event sponsored by Western Michigan University's Center for the Humanities. Bill McKibben, thank you very much for taking some time to speak with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Let's begin with your group. It's called 350.org. What does that name mean?
Well, you know, 350 is probably the most important number in the world, though no one knew it until about 5 years ago. In 2008, our most important climatologist, Jim Hansen at NASA, and his team published a paper saying, we know now enough to say how much carbon in the atmosphere is too much. Any value for carbon dioxide greater than 350 parts per million is, as they put it, not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. Now, that's strong language for scientists to use. But, of course, it's considerably stronger still if you know that wherever you are today, in Michigan or in Mongolia, the atmosphere outside is closing in on 400 parts per million, going up about 2 parts per million per year. We've already got too much carbon in the atmosphere. That's why the Arctic is melting at a rapid rate. It's why the oceans are 30% more acidic than they were 40 years ago. In fact, are acidifying faster, according to a paper that came out yesterday, than any time for the last 300 million years. It's why we see an increase in freakish and strange weather because warm air can hold more water vapor than cold, amplifying both drought and flood. We're in a world of hurt already because we're way north of that 350 number.
Is there a way to get it back down to 350 or below that?
If we stop burning coal and gas and oil, that's the sine qua non, then forests and oceans will take that excess carbon out of the atmosphere slowly. That's what they've been doing for a very long time. That's why it's all buried away there in coal and gas and oil deposits. By the end of this century, we'd be, if we stopped burning fossil fuel tomorrow, we'd be back somewhere near the 350 markup. A lot of damage would have been done in the meantime. We're no longer at a place where stopping climate change is one of our options. The question is, how bad will it get? So far, we've raised the temperature about 1 degree Celsius, 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's caused the trouble I described before. But the same scientists who told us that would happen now tell us with confidence that we'll raise the temperature 3 or 4 degrees Celsius, 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit this century. And if we do that, really there's no good reason to think we can have civilizations that look like the one we have now.
So why is your latest book called Oil and Honey?
Well, half of it's about the sort of oil theft is about this work that I've been doing now for some years of trying to build the big global movement to do something about climate change, work that's beginning to have some success, though by no means yet capable of really standing up to the weight of the fossil fuel industry. The honey part's about the few stretches I've been able to carve out close to home in Vermont. And in Vermont, we're doing what we can to figure out how to build kind of local economies and local food systems and things. It's been beautiful to watch. And I focus on a character near me, a wonderful guy named Kirk Webster, who's an apiarist, a beekeeper, one of the first chemical-free apiarists in the country, and a very lovely part of this increasingly robust Vermont local system. And the point I'm trying to make is, we need both these things. We do need a far more localized world that's not too big to fail, that can provide with a minimum of inputs of energy and things, the food and other things that we need. But if that's all we do, it won't work because we also need a global solution to this problem. The temperature is already high enough that we're having freakish rainfall events in places like Vermont. Hurricane Irene broke every record we had for 200 years of record keeping, and it washed away a lot of our small farms. So this is an emergency.
You make an interesting observation in the book about the way that bees operate in their hive and how it compares with the United States political system. Explain that a little bit for us.
Well, there's a couple of things that interested me. One was the kind of comparison of bees to corporations, and I was trying to think about that Citizens United decision and why it was that it felt so wrong to me that corporations were given the power of speech. And it's because I think that in a certain way, corporations are more like bees than like people. Bees are very remarkable creatures, and I love them dearly, but they're simple also. They do one thing, and they do it extraordinarily well. Human beings are different than that. We're complicated. We have instinctual desires and cravings and things. We'll keep, you know, we'll do certain things, but we also have forces outside ourselves, art, the making of significance out of nothing, you know, religion, which at least since the Buddha has taught us to suspect our instincts and cravings somewhat. We can think about our grandchildren and our ancestors, and those things can check us some in our impulses and cravings. Bees don't have that, and neither do corporations. Given the power of speech, corporations won't use them to reflect or anything else. If you want to do something like tap the tar sands for oil, then you need a corporation. It's a hard, complicated job. You need to assemble a lot of equipment from all around the world, so on and so forth. A corporation's very good at that. But if you want to figure out whether tapping into the tar sands would be a good idea or not, really, corporations need to be kept out of it. Their very simplistic love of wealth will combine with the power that that wealth brings to just make sure that their speech won't be helpful. In the same way that if you want to know whether or not, if you want honey, you need bees. But if you want to know whether making honey would be a good idea or not, bees would really be the last people you'd want to ask.
Tar sands oil ended up being spilled into the Kalamazoo River in 2010, and that is still being cleaned up as we speak right now. What did that whole situation tell us about climate change and our quest to get energy and all of these issues that are sort of all interconnected in some way?
Well, they should have told us that we're now at the very extreme edges of trying to satisfy our energy appetites. Instead of taking the cue from the natural world as the easy oil began to run out and switching over to sun and the wind, which we could quite plausibly do, instead, because you can get rich doing it, some people have continued to insist that we're stay hooked to oil and coal and gas. And if we're going to do that, then we're going to need to do very extreme things. We're going to need to frack. We're going to need to drill miles underwater where we don't really know what we're doing, or up in the Arctic. And we're going to need to exploit very, very disgusting resources like the tar sands of Canada, where that oil that spilled in the Kalamazoo River came from. This stuff is the dirtiest of the dirty, the bottom of the barrel. It's the dirtiest oil on earth. And you guys got firsthand sense of that when it spilled in the Kalamazoo River. It's not easy to clean up this stuff. So, you know, as we fight this epic fight about the Keystone Pipeline, a bigger version of the pipe that's spilled in Kalamazoo, I'm afraid one of the object lessons that people across Nebraska and Texas and Oklahoma and things keep turning to is your sad experience there. When Inside Climate News won the Pulitzer Prize last year for their coverage of that spill, I think it helped people realize that this was more than a local issue, that it was tied into this very important global battle.
I interviewed the editor of Inside Climate News before they won their Pulitzer, but after the stories had been published. And she said part of the reason they did the story was they thought that this was a story that flew under the radar. Are there other environmental-type stories out there, things that could bring more attention to these issues that tend to fly under the radar because perhaps they're seen as local issues and not necessarily seen as a bigger overriding issue of climate?
Sure. Most environmental stories fly under the radar, mostly because they're likeliest to affect people in what the centers of power perceive as out-of-the-way places or poor people or otherwise powerless people. look, most of the damage that's coming from climate change at this point is coming to people who we never listen to. When was the last time you paid any attention to anyone in Africa, anybody in Bengal, anyone in all the places that daily are suffering the effects of climate change? So it's, you know, the rare, in a sense, the rare story about the environment that actually does get out on the ongoing day-by-day degradation of the planet around us is the great untold story. It happens sometimes just a tiny bit too slowly for the kind of news knows to sense, but it's on geological time scale happening with almost unbelievable speed. I mean, looking at this ocean acidification study yesterday, a team of international scientists said it looks to us like the sixth great mass extinction in the planet's history is already well underway.
You mentioned the Keystone XL pipeline. The congressman who represents this area, Fred Upton, is the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and he has been calling for the Keystone pipeline to be approved. Recently, he wrote that the State Department found that without the pipeline, the oil sands will find their way to markets by other means of transportation, which could actually produce a larger carbon footprint. And he goes on to say that the bottom line is that regardless of a new carbon litmus test, this abundant energy resource will be developed. What would you say to that as someone who opposes the pipeline?
I think he's empirically wrong. You know, the Canadians and their fans like Mr. Upton have been saying, oh, they'll just build another pipeline to the Pacific Coast and get the oil out that way. But people in the Pacific Coast blocked that. The British Columbians said, no way are you going to build a pipeline here. They and First Nations people across Canada were successful in stopping that. And TransCanada, who wants to build the Keystone Pipeline, said, oh, well, then we'll build a pipeline to the east coast of Canada. They don't really want to do it because the Maritimes are further away from China than they want to be, but they said, we'll do it. So much opposition to that already that they announced yesterday that there's a year's delay already in that pipeline proposal. I bet it never gets built. Congressman Upton is the perfect example of the person who should know better. This was a man who acknowledged climate change for a long time. Then the Tea Party took over and he wanted to be chair of the Energy Committee and he went back on all his understanding of science. He's the kind of example of why I think Americans have contempt for politicians these days.
A former Republican Congressman, Bob Inglis, who represented part of South Carolina, was recently interviewed on our station. He agreed that climate change is real, but he says he wants a more market-based approach to fight it. He proposes a tax on carbon emissions while reducing other taxes, and he says that would be preferable to multiple regulations. Is that doable?
I think that basically environmentalists have for 25 years called for a serious price on carbon. I mean, it's outrageous that this is the only industry that's allowed to pollute for free. In essence, Exxon owns the sky. They're allowed to put as much carbon as they want into the atmosphere at no cost, even though it's the most dangerous thing we know about now on the planet. And so I think former Congressman Inglis is exactly right about this. He's just not getting much traction in Washington because our supposed, you know, market-based conservatives and stuff are neither market-based nor conservative. They're willing to do the bidding of the fossil fuel industry who give them campaign contributions, and they're not at all interested in conservation of the one planet that we've got.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a report in late September. It showed that climate change has been caused by human behavior. It can have serious consequences. It also showed, however, a pause in global warming. Do you have any idea how this can be explained?
Sure. I mean, it didn't show a pause. It said that the last decade was by far the warmest decade we've had. But what they said was, for the moment, the heat is going into the oceans. 93% or so of the extra heat in the last decade has ended up in the oceans, where it will inevitably come back out and be expressed into the atmosphere. So the effects of that are obvious all around us. The rapid melt of pretty much everything frozen on the planet, for instance, or the strange weather that we see week after week, day after day, year after year. So I take no comfort at all from that. In fact, the same scientific body that you just said we have got to get to work. This is by far the biggest thing that human beings have ever done and the biggest threat the planet's ever faced.
Let's go back to that subtitle of your book. Why do you consider yourself an unlikely activist?
Well, you know, I'm a writer. Training and inclination, and writers are kind of introverts and not really designed for this kind of work. But at a certain point, it was pretty clear to me that writing another book on all of this wasn't going to move the needle, and that we needed to organize. We were never going to be able to outspend the fossil fuel industry, so we better find some other kind of currency. And the only one I could think of with this sort of currency is a movement. Passion, spirit, creativity. So that's what we tried to muster. 350.org has run about 15 or 20,000 protests in every country on Earth except North Korea. It's been good fun to watch it spread around the world, and it's been good fun to watch it sharpen the fight over the Keystone Pipeline or the powerful call for divestment of fossil fuel stocks, which Oxford University study yesterday said was the fastest-growing divestment movement in history. And the thing most likely to pose a real challenge to the power of the fossil fuel industry.
I want to read something that you wrote in Rolling Stone not so long ago. You're not a member of the resistance just because you drive a Prius. You don't need to go to jail, but you do need to do more than change your light bulbs. What is there for the regular citizen to do that's between going to jail and just changing light bulbs?
Organize. Active citizens. Look, and our role as consumers, we can have some effect. So put in a good light bulb. There's no reason not to and every reason to do it. But don't limit your action to there. What we really need you doing is working as citizens. That means joining movements like 350.org. It means standing up to people like Congressman Upton when they defy science and common sense. It means really trying to make a difference. And you know what? If you have to go spend a night in jail for civil disobedience, it's not the end of the world. The end of the world is the end of the world, and that's why we carry on this fight.
How much have you learned about our political system over these last couple of years, and how disturbing do you find it?
I find it pretty disturbing. I got to say, I never spent much time in Washington, but it turns out that every vote that's been taken on the Keystone Pipeline, for instance, the best indicator, the perfect indicator of how someone will vote, with how much money they've taken from the fossil fuel industry. It's disgusting. I mean, it's, you know, no different than if the, I was watching baseball playoffs last night. It's no different as if the umpires, you know, as if the owner of the Red Sox had, or the Tigers or someone had paid the umpires. It's horrible. But it's where we are, and so the only good thing is, we have to find these other things than money. We have to put some fear into these guys, and that can only be done as we act as citizens, if we organize.
If we are going to truly fix climate change and bring carbon dioxide levels back below that 350 number that you mentioned earlier, at some point, will that change the convenience that we have become accustomed to in terms of what we drive and the amount of electricity we use with various things like computers and iPhones, things like that?
I don't think there's any worry about iPhones. All things considered, they don't use much. I do think it's unlikely that in a world that took climate change seriously, we just have ubiquitous jet travel everywhere all the time, there'll be changes. I think for the most part, there'll be changes for the best as we build out the sun and the wind infrastructure that's sort of inherently localized. We'll get more localized economies and be less dependent on the rest of the world, stronger local communities, but we'll still have those larger ties that come through this new thing, the internet, which, I mean, I probably, it was up to me, it'd be the last thing I'd turn off, and I don't think we're going to need to.
You mentioned jet travel, and there's an interesting quote from you pretty early in the book about how it occurred to me that there's something remarkably ironic about my flying around the world to create a climate movement. How did you end up sort of reconciling that in your own mind?
Well, some days I don't, and it always feels weird. But the best I can do is, this is a structural problem, and we're going to have to change those structures if we're going to do anything about it. And the only way to do that, I think, is to build a movement. The 350.org, we've tried to build it as locally as we can. I'm pretty much the only moving part, and I'm wearing out as a moving part. So for many reasons, I'm very eager not to be doing it anymore. more and more and more I'm able to work, do my work via Skype and things. And I'd much rather do that than ever get on a plane again.
Bill McKibben, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bill McKibben is the founder of the group 350.org. His latest book is called Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Bill McKibben will speak tomorrow night, beginning at 7 o'clock in Miller Auditorium. The event is part of Western Michigan University's Center for the Humanities Changing Climates series.